The Senate Budget Judiciary Budget Division will meet. Today is Thursday, February 25th, in the year 2010. We will start out by continuing the testimony and the impact of the governor's supplemental budget bill. And the first testifier will be Chief Judge George Perez of the Minnesota Tax Court. Thank you. Judge, would you be kind enough to state your name for the record?
My name is George Perez, Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. Thank you, Senator Foley, and thank you, members of the Senate Committee. I have two handouts that were passed out. One is the our filing fees summation along with our budget. And if I can make a few statements first, or do you want to take questions?
Let's have the statements first.
Okay. If you want to follow along on the form that I provided, 2008 is for historical purposes. If you go down to the middle of the page, which is 2009 filings, what I have highlighted in black total is $1,000,173,240. That's the amount of fees that we collected last year, and our budget was at $825,000. If we go down to 2010, our estimated budget has been cut to 118. It's been cut by 37,000, and it is currently at 818. What we expect to bring in, if all numbers are the same as last year, it would be $1,460,000, which would more than cover our budget. Along with what I provided was an article from the Minnesota Lawyer, which talked about it said the Minnesota Tax Court is poised to have its busiest year ever. Well, we did in 2009. In 2010, we're already 50% ahead of that. So if you flip the page over with the numbers, you'll see that if there's only a 25% increase, by fees alone, we would bring in $1,825,000. And again, our budget is at 818. More likely, we may have a 50% increase, which would mean that we would bring in $2,190,000. And again, our budget is earmarked for 818. Below that, there are fines that we impose from time to time. It's a smaller amount, but that's $5,900 for 2009. Probably somewhere in the same vicinity for 2010. So I guess the first point that I wanted to make to the committee is that our budget is more than covered by the amount of fees that we receive that are generated by those that file before the tax court. The second point is that the current cut, which is $37,000, will require us to close our doors for 2 weeks. That is the only way that we can make up the cut or the shortage that we are being asked to take. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Betts.
Just a clarification. I'm not sure what the abbreviations are, but it says one column says PPY and one says COR.
Yes.
What do they stand for?
Property Tax Appeals and Commissioner of Revenue. Okay. Cases. Those are the two types of cases that we receive. We have miscellaneous cases from other areas, but those are the two primary sources of cases that get appealed to the tax court.
Any other questions of Judge Perez? Hearing none. You may conclude your presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
want you to know before you leave that I do appreciate the way your operation is being run, and thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you, members of the committee.
We're now looking at the Uniform Laws Commission, Senator Jack Davies. Welcome.
My name is Jack Davies, and I'm one of the eight Minnesota commissioners on Uniform State Laws. I think you're all quite familiar with our organization because we on a regular basis bring the products of the work of the commission to the legislature seeking adoption of the statutes that the conferences have drafted. We try to take on the complicated issues, detailed kind of work that's a real burden to the various state legislatures, including this one, and give you a product that's worked out in ways that will be useful to you. And since you're all so familiar with this, I'll just yield to questions at this time.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
I should comment one other thing, Mr. Chairman. The cut that the governor has proposed, or the Department of Administration has proposed, we have agreed that we can live with those, the 2,000 cut each year. It might hurt the conference if we short their dues, but we'll have to do that.
Any questions of Judge Davies? Thank you for your work on this wonderful pot.
Well,
appreciate that.
It's not only work, it's also great fun. So
okay, cut them more.
We're all workaholics.
That's true.
Thank you very much, Chairman, members of the committee.
We're moving right along. We'll look at the judicial branch and understand that Ms. Suda DeSalle is going to make a presentation.
My name is Sue DeSalle. I'm the State Court Administrator, and I'm here today to, along with several other presenters, to talk to you a little bit about our current situation in terms of the judicial branch budget and the impact of the governor's proposed recommendation. Just, you know, to give you a little context here and put our situation in into that context. So the judicial branch has been underfunded for a number of years. If we go back to the last recession, 2004-05, this was just as we were bringing over to full state funding the largest of our judicial districts, and we ended up with a $23 million shortfall in that biennium. In 2006-07, there was no restoration of that funding. In 2008-09, last biennium, we had another $19 million shortfall that included a $4 million cut. For this biennium, we have a $5 million cut, and in addition, we had to absorb $6.3 million in unavoidable personnel costs. These are costs for statutorily mandated increases in the employer contribution to pensions, health insurance increases for employees that are negotiated, and also annualization of step increases that were given, mandated by contract in 2009 that carried over into 2010. So what that meant for us in this biennium is essentially a $12 million hit to our budget. So because of this chronic underfunding, we are now operating 10% short staff with about 250 fewer positions than we had in 2008. We reduced this workforce in a number of ways by implementing a voluntary separation program, voluntary leave without pay, instituted a hiring freeze, and we've had to resort to some layoffs already to get to this point. In addition to contain costs, we also negotiated for this biennium with our three unions a zero merit and zero across the board increases for both years. And even in the 8th Judicial District, the work hours were cut from 40 to 37, and this resulted in effectively a 6.25% pay cut to the employees in that district. In addition, as part of our budget plan to close the gap, we are now holding open all judge vacancies for a minimum of 4 months. And we've taken cuts to retired services, which results in exacerbating the problem of our under-judged situation already. In addition, we've had to take cuts to our drug court. And to try and deal with those cuts and with expiring federal grants that we've had, we were hoping to get some federal stimulus money. We made an application for $3.9 million for our drug court program in Minnesota, and unfortunately there were some 2,200 to 2,500 applications, and ours was not approved. We've also had to cut mandated services in our operating budgets. We now have expanded the number of counties in which the public counters are having to be closed half a day a week to more than half of our districts. We've canceled more and most of our educational meetings, all to reduce costs. And finally, because of this chronic underfunding and with what we believe is the certainty of ongoing fiscal concerns in the next 3 or more years, the Judicial Council felt that it was necessary that we change the way that we allocate funding to our judicial districts. In the past, our counties were essentially placed into three categories based on size, and the smaller courts received funding based on a proportionally more staff per judge, in recognition that these smaller counties couldn't affect the economies of scale and efficiencies of the larger counties. But with the continued fiscal pressures now and the future, the Judicial Council concluded that we could no longer afford to provide low volume and geographically disperse areas with proportionally higher staff levels. And so as a result, the council made the decision that no, regardless of the size now, all of our counties and districts are funded on the same workload basis. Now, this will have an impact, and recognizing that, the council agreed to phase this in over 3 years, and this would allow a time for adjustment to these new lower levels of budget and staff, hopefully achieved through attrition. It also would allow time for the implementation of some planned technology initiatives that we have underway, which we hope would allow the smaller counties and courts to operate with smaller budgets and fewer staff. Some of the technologies include the centralized payables initiative, e-citation, and e-filing that I'll talk a little bit more about. But still, even with that technology, we are concerned and believe that probably in these low-volume areas that it is going to result in less service and may likely result in fewer hours that courts are going to be open, perhaps even fewer days per week. Tim Osby, who is the Judicial District Administrator for the 7th and 8th District, is here and is going to talk a little bit later and talk more about that impact. Now, we haven't just been sitting and cutting only, but indeed we have taken this time to redouble our efforts to find court process efficiencies and to expand the use of technology to reduce costs with the goal of trying to do whatever we can to continue to provide the quality of justice and the service, levels of service, that we can do as much as possible. Now, with your help last session, we now are in the process of centralizing the processing of our $1.2 million payables and the collection of old debt on those payables. Now, this fall, we launched what we call the Minnesota Court Payment Center, and are going to be transitioning 85 of the counties over to the centralized process over this next 2 years. And then our expectation would be to bring in Hennepin and Ramsey in the following biennium. Each of them have their own centralized processes. So that's what our plan is. Obviously, the goal here, as we talked to you last session, was to save money, to increase collections, to bring in rightful revenue to state and local government, and what we hope would be to provide an alternative and acceptable level of public service. And this really is going to be crucial as we move to this lowest norm in the more rural areas. In addition, we've been working very hard to expand technology with our justice partners, also to try and take down costs for us and for them. And this has included e-citations, electronic transfer of citations from law enforcement, e-charging from prosecutors. The BCA has been awarded a $1 million stimulus grant, and we think this is going to go a long ways towards expanding e-charging throughout the state. Also e-filing. Right now we have a pilot for civil e-filing in Hennepin County that we're working on and expect to have underway in this biennium. All of these, of course, are aimed at trying to reduce the amount of manual processing for all of this paper and to reduce costs overall. In the jury area, we've centralized 87 separate jury management databases, and that means that people who are called for jury service can fill out those questionnaires online, frees up court staff. We are also beginning to roll out a online system for conservators to use for those statutorily mandated annual accounting reports. This, too, will reduce manual work and improve the quality and the oversight of these kinds of cases. ITV expansion is something that we've been working on. This is a recommendation that came out of the Criminal Justice Forum, and the Chief Justice put together a task force, made recommendations for how we could expand the use of ITV in criminal matters, that proposal is now out for comment, and we expect the Supreme Court to act upon that sometime this spring. And finally, we are continuing with the Criminal and Civil Justice Forum groups to try and find efficiencies, and we are working in front of the Judicial Council now are a series of recommendations, longer-term recommendations in terms of re-engineering our service delivery, dealing with the judicial district redistricting proposals, also the issue of the judicial unit as well. So many things that we have underway, and I can assure you that the judicial branch takes seriously our responsibility to maximize the efficiency and effectiveness of the scarce resources that we're given. So, taking to now the governor's cut with an already underfunded court system. Counters closed part of the week in many counties around the state. We're operating 10% short. The recommendation from the governor is about $13.7 million cut to the courts. In addition, another $1 million to civil legal services that you'll hear about after our presentation. Well, this means that this impact would be on top of what we've already experienced. We think about 77 more positions on top of the 250 we have already lost, about a 13% short staffed statewide. Fewer people means less service, and we know that backlogs and delays are already building across the state. You're going to hear more about that from some of our other presenters. But just as one example, today, 25% of our serious felony cases are taking longer than 1 year. And 1 year delay is important. Nationally, all felonies should be concluded within 1 year. Even our Minnesota statutes require this as a standard. We're not able to meet that standard. And why should we care? Well, of course, justice delay is justice denied. But also, I think it's important to note that the only thing that has been empirically proven to reduce recidivism is the swiftness between the time of the offense and the imposition of a judicial sanction. So the longer this goes, the more and more ineffective we are going to be. We also know that delays in scheduling of all kinds of matters is increasing significantly and doubling in many cases across the state. Now, drug courts are going to be hurt by this as well. With your help and with significant startup money from the federal government, we went from 2 drug courts to 38 within just a few years. We know that what we've done historically with alcohol and drug addicted offenders has not worked. It's been a failure. And we know that these drug courts are working smarter and more effectively to get and keep offenders sober, law-abiding, working, oftentimes tax-paying. And with no new money to take the place of the expiring federal grants and the other needs in the drug courts, we know that these are in jeopardy. The Chisago Juvenile Court has already closed, and we have at least 7 others that are in jeopardy of closing, from Aiken to Wabasha, from Ramsey to Duluth, all over the state. These drug courts that have done such good work are in jeopardy. And finally, depending on the level of cut, our technology and efficiency projects are going to be at risk. And these include things that we're trying to do now to invest up front to take down costs later on. And these are going to include the civil e-filing and document imaging, these e-citations and e-charging efforts, labor-saving MNSIS enhancements, bandwidth expansion to allow us to do more in terms of ITV, and some of our ASD initiatives as well. So that's kind of the big picture of how we see it. These are just significant cuts on top of others that we have taken. We've tightened our belt. We're now down to beyond the bone. So I would like to call on, unless there are some questions of me, call on.
Perhaps you might take questions now, and then we won't lose track of what it is. Senator Betz.
Mr. Sell, I recall that about a year ago when the courts were facing some pretty drastic cuts and we were able to avoid them, the Chief Justice basically had his list and said, you know, there's just some things we're just not going to be able to do anymore. Now, we were able to avoid that, but are we getting to the point where he's going to have to pull that list out again and said, we're just going to have to, you know, quit hearing certain types of cases because we just don't have the resources?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, there's no question that we're close to that point. And the Judicial Council, even at its last meeting, began to take a look at that list to confirm that we still feel that was the case, take a look at what these filings are and the cost now, and we're beginning that assessment as we speak. Depending on the level of cuts, I think there's no question that this will begin to be in play.
And Senator Betz. Mr. Chair, Ms. Dussel, do the governor's recommendations push us into that area where that list has to come out and we start looking at things the courts will not do anymore?
Mr. Chair and Senator Betzel, we think that it's close to that. Actually, making a decision that we are no longer going to be able to handle these cases or suspend these cases is a territory we haven't been in before. we're close to that, and we're very concerned about it, and I know that the Judicial Council is working on it as we speak. But the issue is, do we delay everything across the board with no prioritization, or do we prioritize and say some things just have to be done at a certain level, and other things without the resources can't be? And that's really the question here that we hope the dialogue with the legislature and the governor
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Higginbotham, did you have... Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dosell, have you added anything, any items to the payables list recently? I know that sometimes that's... we've had some odd conversations about about the payables list and what should be migrated there. Could you talk about what you've done there?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, you know, every year the Judicial Council looks at and approves the payables list. A new payables list was approved last summer and effective, I think, in this January. There were a few items that were added, but not many.
Okay, thanks.
In your savings, if you will, and I know that you have some initiatives that you work with, it's been an issue that obviously we'd like to know what direction you're going on that. I don't know whether your timetable is to bring someone else out, or you were going to do it yourself.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I have a hearing problem, so I have a hard time understanding what you're saying. I can't hear it. It's just me. It's a timetable for what?
For implementation of any of these and other types of cost savings activities.
The technology, for example, you're talking about? We're working on the centralized payables now, and we are underway. There are a number of counties that have already transitioned. Our goal is to have the 85 counties outside of Hennepin and Ramsey transition to the centralized payables by the end of this biennium. That's our goal. Hennepin and Ramsey already have their own centralized process and have really, wrung all of the efficiencies out. So we think that having those stay by themselves until we've done the rest works. Civil e-filing, we believe that we will be able to bring that up in this biennium in Hennepin County as a pilot. Our plan was in the next biennium to roll that out to all of the rest of the state in the next biennium. But that's going to be contingent on what happens here in cuts. If there are cuts, that is one of the first things we're likely not going to be able to do unless we rethink something about that. So that's certainly in jeopardy. The e-citations and e-charging, as I said, the e-charging with the ECA grant, we hope that will go a long way toward bringing prosecutors over on an e-charging system in this biennium. E-citations, it really requires local law enforcement to put some funding into reprogramming their current systems to make that happen. So that will depend on their ability to do that, and we don't control that. We are encouraging that, and there are, a number of law enforcement agencies that are doing it, but we don't control that.
What kind of numbers are you looking at as far as implementing it? It seems to me that if your implementation of that can have significant help to your overall budget process.
Well, it certainly will. We have made some estimates about the centralized payables and what that might mean for us in terms of savings, and we're thinking something in the order of 50 FTE for the centralized payables processing. We're not quite sure yet about civil e-filing and what that kind of impact will be. We're going to know more once we've done this Hennepin pilot, which I think gets launched in, it's targeted now for June of this year. So we don't have estimates on that yet.
Thank you. Any further questions of Mr. Sell? All right. We'll have your next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Edward Toussaint, and I serve on the Minnesota Court of Appeals as its chief judge. I just might want to also indicate, I included in these slides some information that the panel, that the committee may already know, that we are a 19-member court. We have statewide jurisdictions. We hear cases from, of course, the district court, with all cases with the exception of first-degree murder, which goes directly to the Minnesota Supreme Court. We also hear, we don't hear those statewide election contests. Those cases go directly to the Minnesota Supreme Court. But all other cases, whether it comes from a county board, a township board, whether it comes from a state agency, a school board, where citizens are aggrieved, they have a right of appeal to the Minnesota Supreme, Minnesota Court of Appeals. We do not have an option as the Supreme Court of denying further review for those decisions. And as we say, we have statewide jurisdictions. Chapter 488 says that we have to hear those cases in the region where those cases arise. And so we travel, whether it goes from now Detroit Lakes to Rochester, from Duluth to New Ulm to Worthington, we hear cases in those localities. So we have this in-state travel on the part of our court in order to be able to hear grievances from those cases which are appealed from that particular area. You all have been part of all of this budget discussions in our court for a number of years, and you've known that we've gone through a couple of highs and a couple of lows. And I just want to just talk to you a little bit about, so first of all, the highs. In 2007, you agreed that we should get an additional panel of judges, which also brought with them additional law clerks. And as a result of that, there has been some significant impact on the process of processing of cases, but I'll talk to you a little bit about that in the next slide. But even with the 2010 budget reductions, we've had to, again, reduce our budget and also, therefore, reduce some of the services that we are rendering. We are increasing the use of interactive video for those outstate locations, and those the interactive video allows both the party, the real people who are in interest, to be able to attend those hearings. Sometimes when counsel from a non-metropolitan area chooses to come to the Twin Cities, those clients are unable to attend those hearings. So the interactive video serves many, many purposes, not only to the parties, but also to reduce some of the costs. As I said, we travel to all of our many jurisdictions within the state of Minnesota. We are in the process of evaluating those areas of the state where we travel. We do travel within all of the 8 congressional districts. Some places where the hearings are going to be scheduled will have less travel time, which means less costs and expense both to the members of the court and also to the parties. So we are reevaluating that. As a consequence of the 2010 budget cuts, we no longer reimburse for any out-of-state travel. Educational opportunities for our judges, for appellate judges, generally does not exist at the state level, so many of our judges travel to other localities in order to be able to get some of their education. Sometimes, well, more often than not, that's funded by whatever the institution who's putting on the appellate review seminars. So we've had some reductions in the number of retired judges that we use, and also we really monitor the total amount that we are expending in that particular area. We've had a reduction in law clerks. As you can see, each of our law clerks do about 35 bench memos, which relate to cases per year. So each time we reduce that number, we're reducing the number of total cases that we hear in a given year. Each of our panels, as we are currently constituted, hears about 252 cases a year. We are now filing probably about 1,700 or so opinions annually, which is up from the 1,500 or so that we were scheduling and issuing opinions when we had a 16-member court. So that additional panel has made a significant impact on our case processing. As a result of the 2010 budget shortfall, we reduced our the number of law clerks by 6.9, and as, if you just multiply 35 by that, you will get an understanding of the number of fewer cases that we have the capacity of hearing. Fortunately for us, we have innovative judges on our court. Judge Lansing is here. She is our leader on the family law mediation project, which is one of the first time that we've had family law mediation at the Court of Appeals level. When we started this, people said, you shouldn't do that. It's not going to work. Why is it going to work? Well, they didn't settle at the trial court. Why would you think that they're going to settle at the Court of Appeals level? Well, because of the organization and the number of mediators that we've been having, we are now getting a 50% settlement rate. Now, many people have thought that that was the purpose of us instituting that family law mediation was to reduce our backlog, to have an impact on our case processing. But what we found in our study of other states that have family law mediation at the appellate level is that it's the satisfaction of the parties that really matter, whether they will be able to have some input in the resolution of those issues. So we've been very successful because of the efforts of our mediators and, as I said, Judge Lansing, who continues to push us forward to make sure that this is a streamlined process. So we have ultimately been very successful in resolving that particular case type. And no, we have not looked forward to trying to develop a process for trying to have mediation at the appellate court level for other case types in the event that you have that as a potential question. So ultimately, the impact of the governor's proposed budget results in us having, again, a reduction of our law clerks by an additional number of them. So what's the impact? Now, for those of you who have had an opportunity to see the movie Back to the Future, you'll know that that was a movie that went back as far as 1885 to 1955, and there was an impact impacting the past that really impacted the future. And I just want to read one little line of that the last of the of that particular episode. There were three Back to the Future movies, and Doc, who is one of the main protagonists in the movie, he was asked this question. Marty asked Doc if his family are going to the future. Doc replies that he's already been to the future. Now, I read that line just primarily to indicate to you we, in taking a look at these proposed cuts, we've already been there. And you have as a result of your work, allowed us to be able to recover from that. And so I just want to show you just exactly what has occurred. And I'm going to be, it's also on your document in the event that you're unable to see the numbers on the screen. In November of 2007, we had 741 cases that were awaiting scheduling. We had already made our request to the legislature, and you agreed to grant us the opportunity to have an additional three-judge panel. You agreed also that we would have those additional law clerks. But then what's the upshot of all of that? As we look at today, February 22nd, we have now 198 cases awaiting scheduling. So you see that significant reduction. And we have divided those between orals and non-orals. We don't have to really search in our minds too much about what the impact of a budget shortfall should be, because we've already seen that in our past. And so the impact would, of course, be an additional delay. And, of course, delay only really ultimately affects the parties who come to our court for the resolution, timely resolution of their issues. And with that, I will entertain any questions that you might have.
Senator Betzel.
Judge, I was trying to figure out what conclusions I should be drawing about the mandate that the panels have to hear the cases in the areas where the district court case was tried. And that may have been a good idea when the Court of Appeals was being set up. So is it so necessary that we do that anymore? I mean, because we're talking about basically the lawyers.
We're having a hard time on this end. Hearing you, Senator.
Okay. I'm trying to understand the requirement, the mandate of having the panel travel to the panels have to travel to the areas where the cases were tried, and is that really necessary? Because the lawyers are basically arguing, whether the district court was right or wrong. And bring up the legal arguments. It will be more cost effective. Is it really necessary to have them in the regions, or could it be done better just to tell the parties to just come to the Court of Appeals in St. Paul and make their arguments? I don't know which way it ought to be going, but there certainly would be cost savings if we did not have that requirement.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, and members. Chapter 480A says that we must travel to those, the area wherein the case arises. That's our responsibility. Unless that statute is changed, then of course we don't have inherent authority not to agree with the statute. Cost savings. It costs us not only the windshield time to get there and back, and then of course the travel cost reimbursement. So that's those are the costs to us. Where we go, locality provides the courtroom for us and some of the court staffing of those hearings. So that's not a direct cost to us. When we have ITV hearings, we have a per minute charge for our ITV hearings of cases that don't arise out of the 14-county region. There's a cost differential between those. I haven't been able to determine what the difference would be if we take a look at it per case basis. But yes, it would be less costly for us to travel. But then we would also be breaking the deal. For those of you who've been around since before 1983, when we began, you know that there was an agreement that which found its way in statute, that one of the grievances was that the people outside of the 14-county region did not see its appellate court. And so we have this requirement to travel, which serves more than just one purpose. It also allows for the parties then, of course, to be integrally involved in this litigation and therefore be have an idea as to what that process is all about. So, yes, it might be less costly for us to travel, but then we have some other unintended consequences as a result of that.
Mr. Chairman, Judge Toussaint, of course, the legislature could change the statute and then make it discretionary for the travel. I just wanted to get the ideas if there's sound public policy from having it. You mentioned the historical considerations that was something that the legislature in 1983 desired. As I recall, of course, the idea for the Court of Appeals in the first case was to have a process by which the litigants could have a speedy resolution to their appeals and not have to wait for a very long period of time for the Supreme Court to resolve them. I'm just wondering if, because of these budget considerations that you've been describing, whether we're falling back on that part of the deal as well, because are people really getting their speedy decisions on sometimes or maybe technical matters, sometimes substantive, but you know, if the Court of Appeals is not as quick as we intended to, is there a trade-off there that maybe having a case heard, you know, in areas of the state is not serving its purpose anymore?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, and members, we began to rectify that bit of a delay in the resolution of those cases when we asked and you agreed that we would get an additional panel. And you can see the numbers are coming down significantly, which would then allow us to meet that responsibility of being able to timely resolve the issues that are coming before us. And those numbers, as we are presently constituted, are gradually going down. And when we first came to you and asked for that additional panel, we projected that it would take us 5 years to get down to a level like this. I can't begin to tell you all the other things that our court has done in order to be able to try to process all those cases. But we've done some additional things other than just have the additional panel. Because we found that it was necessary for us to do that in order to be able to meet this responsibility of being able to timely resolve those cases.
And Mr. Chair, one other question. I'm not sure, is the caseload increasing? I'm not quite sure. I know the numbers of that. Are more appeals being filed to the Court of Appeals these days?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, and members, we're going to get our report on Monday, and I didn't get any preliminary determinations. We do have some indications that we're having a little bit of an uptick in civil litigation. Criminal is remaining pretty constant, but a steady increase. A couple of years ago, criminal outpaced general civil. Our family law cases are remaining at about 250-some-odd cases annually, and that's pretty constant. The statute has 518 has remained pretty constant over time, so there's not a lot of other litigation other than disputes between the parties. We've had it appears as though we're having a little bit of an uptick in the number of cases filed to our court.
Thank you. Thank you.
Further questions? Can you tell me, Judge, you discussed the mediation?
Yes.
And is that court-ordered?
Mr. Chair and members, the family mediation project is court-ordered. All family law cases, and we are also looking at those 4D cases wherein the county pays and then seeking reimbursement from one of the parents. We had not looked at those, including those in the family law mediation project, but we're going to see whether we can also incorporate those cases. But, yes, there is an order that comes out to from our court spelling out to the parties what the process is as selection of a mediator. Once that mediator is selected, the parties then contact that mediator for the mediation process. The mediator then returns to us and indicating whether or not the mediation was successful. If it was successful, then we send a letter to the district court indicating to the district court that this case that had been appealed to us has been successfully mediated, and then the parties then ultimately will enter into a judgment in the district court. We could not, on our court, issue an order for judgment. Only the district court can do that. If the mediation is unsuccessful, what we have promised the people who are involved in the mediation process, there's going to be a slight delay in the processing of your case, but we're going to keep your place in line in regard to all the other cases that have been appealed to our court. So that if you are unsuccessful, you will be in no worse place than you would be had you not gone through that process. And so, therefore, the briefing occurs. If it's unsuccessful, they're placed on the calendar to be either an on-oral conference or an oral conference, is right along with the other cases that had been appealed at that same time. So that process is fair from a procedural standpoint and also fair from the a merit-based part in order to be able to resolve those issues.
Mr. Chairman, Judge Toussaint, on appeal when you're going through a mediation process, are the parties bound by the findings of the district court? Because, as an example, if there's a child support issue, the district court found a certain level of income and a certain level of expenses, can the parties change that, or is that up to negotiation too in the mediation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, and members, I've not looked personally at these individual settlements as to what has been resolved. Sometimes it appears to me, only anecdotally, that the parties have not only resolved the issues that were appealed to our court, but any other additional disputes that they may have had. So they were not limiting the settlement just to the appealed issues. And we did not tell them in our order that they could only resolve the issues that are on appeal.
But it's possible they could go set aside the findings of the district court, basically, and then and renegotiate a different settlement, which you would then send back to the district court.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, and members, the answer is probably yes.
Okay, thank you.
Judge, one of the issues surfacing, and the governor has taken some movement in that direction, is the implied consent. And it seems to me the Court of Appeals has a significant number of implied consent cases now, but what would be the impact of shifting certain cases to the Court of Appeals that aren't currently, and I'm not sure how that fits in, but can you tell me what how that works, which would be somewhat similar to the child support magistrate function, where they wouldn't have court reporters and other kinds of things?
Mr. Chair and members, I would be... I don't have sufficient information in order to be able to answer that question. We do get a number of implied consents. How many we get, I don't have that number in my mind to tell you just exactly how that would impact our case flow or our caseload. I could find that out and send that information to you, though.
Yep, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, Judge Chassan, the governor's proposed from a budget standpoint to just move implied consent hearings from the district courts over to the Office of Administrative Hearings. But there's been no bill to describe how that's going to be done. And I guess one of the things that we may have to consider, and this is what would deal with the Court of Appeals, is if somebody doesn't like the decision of an administrative law judge and wants to appeal it, Well, they could presumably go to the district court, or they could just take it to the Court of Appeals. Just from the cases that get appealed to the Court of Appeals, straight from administrative law judge's order, would the Court of Appeals have a sufficient record in order to rely on that, or is it better to have those kind of cases go to a district court if somebody doesn't like the administrative law judge's decision, to go to a district court judge to make an adequate record so the Court of Appeals is in a better position, you know, to know, you know, what the issues are? Which is the better way to do it from your standpoint, with the record that you're going to get, from whichever way it gets there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, and members, I've reviewed many cases that have come from the Office of Administrative Hearings. They always have a very adequate record to have effective appellate review. And so, again, I would speak as one less wise because, I don't know just exactly all of the steps in the process that's being contemplated. But as far as preserving the record, the judicial officers at the Office of Administrative Hearings present to us for effective appellate review a very adequate record for that purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before you leave, I just want to indicate that I was really concerned about your discussion on the training. And it's a situation where I find that we should not be squeezing you and taking that training function out of it. Most of the rest of us have some kind of training opportunities, and I see no reason why you shouldn't have that.
Senator Foley and members, the judicial officers in the district court have many opportunities related to their daily work to be able to improve their skill sets. The judges on the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the way in which we process cases, the way we analyze cases, the educational opportunities generally don't exist in the state of Minnesota. I attend a couple of conferences a year. I'm a member of the chief judges of state intermediate appellate courts, and in that programming, I get very specific tips that I get in order to be able to be a better manager as a chief judge. I could only get that from that particular group. And the programming of that group is very specialized. There are a couple of programs, before we allowed our judges to go to NYU, which is a specific programming for intermediate appellate judges, both state and federal, dealing particularly with the issues that appellate judges would be confronted with. But because we no longer reimburse out-of-state travel, some judges have gone on their own dime to those conferences, and some have also been able to get scholarships at other ABA-sponsored seminars outside of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Further questions? Apparently not. Thanks, Judge. I appreciate your
care. Thank you all for your time. Appreciate it.
Are we looking at Mr. Osby? Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
Good afternoon, Chair Foley and members of the committee. My name is Tim Osby, and I am the Judicial District Administrator for the 7th and 8th Judicial Districts. And on the screen, you can see the state map and see the geography that the 7th and 8th Districts cover. I'm here today representing my fellow trial court administrators to talk about the impact of budget shortfalls and cuts over the years, steps we've taken in the districts to close the budget gaps, and the impact of future cuts and our ability to serve the public. As you can see on the map, the 7th Judicial District encompasses 10 counties in the central and western part of the state, and the 8th District has 13 counties directly south of the 7th Judicial District. To reduce costs through attrition and some layoffs, we have gone from 10 court administrators in the 7th District to 5, and from 13 court administrators in the 8th to 5. We've cut our top management staff in these two districts by 60%. We've combined the judicial district administrative offices between the 7th and 8th Judicial District, so I am the sole judicial district administrator for those two districts. And we share HR, finance, and other staff resources between the two districts. By way of example of demonstrating the impact of the budget pressures, I'm going to talk more specifically about the 8th Judicial District. The 8th District is currently authorized for 11 judges, and we have one vacancy at the current time due to retirement, and that is being held open for at least the 4 months that Sue Dosell talked about due to budget shortfalls. Four of the 8th District counties, and now 5, as a result of the retirement, are without chambered judges. As a result, the judges of the 8th District spend considerable time traveling to the counties, and one of our judges routinely holds court in 6 counties. In 2005, the 8th District adopted a management plan creating 3 assignment areas. Ultimately, each assignment area will have one court administrator, and there will be 3 court administrators for the 13 counties of the 8th District. So the concept is that the judges and local court administration offices will have uniform processes so that case file work can be handled in any one of the assignment area county offices. At this time, we have one assignment area managed by one court administrator, Candy-Ohi-Meeker and Swift, and two other assignment areas have 2 administrators each. And at this point in time, we've been able to trim administrators through attrition. Sue talked about the Judicial Council decision to move to the lowest norm, staffing norm, due to the overall underfunding of the judicial branch. And the 8th District has suffered the biggest impact of that decision than any other judicial district in the state. From fiscal year 10 through fiscal year 12, the 3-year phased-in timeline, the district budget will be reduced by 20%, from approximately $6 million in FY09 to $5 million in fiscal year 12. That is before any budgetary cut from the legislative process. And since 2005, the number of employees in the 8th District has been trimmed by 14%. So over the past 2 biennia, we have employed several strategies to contain costs. The judges of the 8th District have voluntarily reduced the number of judicial staff, their court reporters and law clerks, and are operating at 74% of the allotted employees to offset the reduction in funding for court administration staff. As Sue mentioned earlier, the hours of the employees in the 8th District have been reduced from a 40-hour work week to a 37.5-hour work week, resulting in a 6.25% reduction in compensation. And every court administrator office in the district is closed at 2 p.m. on Fridays. We've offered the voluntary separation incentive program, and 7 employees have taken advantage of those offers over the past 5 years, and we have not replaced those employees. The combination of the district administrative functions between the 7th and 8th District, and my serving as the district administrator for both of those districts, has resulted in approximately $300,000 per year of savings. Over the past number of years, the management level positions in the 13 county court administration offices have been reduced from a total of 18. At one point, we had one court administrator in every county and 5 court operations supervisors, or chief deputies, to 7. So we now have 7 management, 5 court administrators, and 2 court operations supervisors. Last year, we centralized the jury management function for the 8th Judicial District, so we have now one jury manager doing the jury management for the 13 counties. In fiscal year 10, our employees voluntarily took salary savings leave without pay, totaling $69,000 for the year, and that has saved approximately 1.5 FTEs. Vacant positions are not being filled. Currently, the Big Stone County Court Administrator Office in Ortonville has one full-time employee and is managed by a court administrator who serves three counties, so a third of a court administrator. And last year, we were forced to lay off three employees in the district and are in the preliminary stages now of developing a layoff plan for the next fiscal years. The governor's proposed budget will result in a 3.5 to 4.5 reduction in our staff through layoff, depending on how that cut would be taken by the branch. The impact of these actions has resulted in several issues ranging from delays in scheduling court hearings and increased time for judicial orders to be prepared, primarily due to the current judicial vacancy and the reduced number of judicial staff. The governor's proposed reductions will exacerbate our precarious situation. The past reductions in court administration management and line staff have been primarily handled with increased use of technology and conversion to the centralized payables process that has been discussed. I don't have any horror stories for you today to talk about what's happened because of these cutbacks. We have excellent employees. The technology that's being employed has worked to date. But future cuts, there are no promises, no guarantees. Further cuts will result in layoffs, and that will begin to impact the handling of cases and the vital public safety information that's relayed from the court to other local and state agencies and the ability to serve the public. I want to close my remarks by telling you that we take seriously the judicial branch's mission to provide justice through a system that assures equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. In these difficult economic times, and toward that end, we recently applied and secured a grant from the Federal State Justice Institute to perform a re-engineering study in the 8th Judicial District. The project is formally entitled Reinventing Rural Justice. The National Center for State Courts will work with us to analyze the impact of dwindling resources on our current service delivery levels, our productivity, performance, and on the stakeholders. It's anticipated that the study will be completed in about 6 months and will provide a framework for options to be considered by the district in terms of ways to re-engineer responsibilities and service delivery options for the district. Still, the administration of justice is a human process, and while the Minnesota judicial branch has a strong track record of innovation and commitment to the efficient use of scarce taxpayer dollars, there are limits on our ability to continue to provide the same level of service with less and less funding. With these proposed cuts, we surely are at that point at this time. It's not unforeseen that many of the recommendations coming from the National Center and this project will include reduction in service hours of local court administration offices or complete shutdown of court administration offices in some of our smaller counties, with judicial services only being offered when the traveling judge comes to town. What's the saddest part, I think, and for me in particular, is that the 8th District 20 years ago was the state funding pilot project. Equal access to justice from one funding source rather than from the 13 counties in the 8th District was piloted, and eventually we were a pilot district for 10 years. Eventually, the legislature phased in the rest of the judicial districts into state funding. And, of course, none of us could have imagined what that is looking like at this time. So I will answer any questions you might have of me.
Any questions of the committee? And this may not be in your particular area, but what possibility could you take the payables and use interconnectivity with some kind of ITV or whatever you got, and then the elimination of this travel thing basis more for the convenience that you and the judge dissent talked about. We're spending an awful lot of time on very high cost but highly necessary functions, and so looking at that, what are your thoughts on IT?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the 8th District uses ITV considerably. We have an ITV site in every county of the district, and the judges routinely use ITV for arraignments, in custody arraignments. If, for instance, in Travers County, there's no chamber judge. If they have an in custody arraignment, and a judge in the northern assignment area is sitting in Morris, they'll do the arraignment by ITV, and that saves the law enforcement transport time from Travers County to Stevens County. In addition, the child support magistrates use ITV extensively. Of the 13 counties in the 8th Judicial District, we have a child support magistrate step into 5 courthouses. So 8 of the counties in the 8th Judicial District are served by magistrates through the use of ITV. One of our contract magistrates is officed in St. Cloud, practices law in St. Cloud. He will go to the Stearns County ITV site and hold magistrate hearings, child support hearings, from St. Cloud into 5 or 6 of our smaller counties in the 8th District in one day. So we have extensively used ITV, and I believe the proposed rules that are being considered by the Supreme Court will allow further expansion of the use of ITV.
Thank you. Committee members, any further questions? Apparently not. We'll move on.
Thank you.
Looking at Judge Meslow, Tenth District.
Chair, nice to see you on your turf over here. Your other turf.
You brought your protection.
I did. I explained to Judge Knudsen that the rest of us were going to scratch out our singles and we were going to let him come up to the plate and bring us all home. So that's as high as I've set the bar, both for myself and for Judge Knudsen. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Meslow. I'm a judge in the 10th Judicial District. That includes the counties of Anoka, Washington, Sherburne, Wright, Pine, Isanti, Chisago, and Kanabic. I spend most of my time sitting in Anoka County, although I have substituted in several of the other counties as well. The latest study report that's about to come out shows that according to national requirements, Minnesota is now 27 judges below the number of judges that we need. And yet, I am not here asking you for one additional judge. The studies also show that judges are getting paid less than our counterparts in other states, and I'm not asking you for one dime in salary. That's because my concern is bigger than either of those. It's for the people that are the lifeblood of what keeps our courts operating. Our court administrative staff, our law clerks, our court reporters. And we're in serious jeopardy right now because of the people that we are losing who keep things rolling. It's, I think, my first experience being in this room, but I've had a little experience, as some of you know, up in this part of town. I spent a few years serving in the House of Representatives, and we had a mantra there. Public safety is a core function of government, and we heard that and said that on committee over and over again. And the idea that I know you believe in as well is that justice isn't just a goal. It's not something that we like to do. It's something we need to do. It's something that we're all about as a part of government. the quality of justice right now is being threatened because of the difficult budget situations that have faced the state. Talking specifically about the 10th, in the last 3 years, we have reduced staff by 10% throughout the 10th. We've got courthouses that are closing at times during the day so that people can't come up to the windows and address things. We've got one courthouse that we've shut down altogether in Washington County, and as Ms. DeSalle explained, we've got a program in Chisago County that was very successful dealing with juvenile drug offenses that we just had to eliminate because we couldn't afford to keep it running anymore. So the question is, what difference does that make? How does that actually affect people? And here are the things that happen as we're not able to do the work, or at least not able to do it on the timetables that we ought to. Think about the family that has moved and they haven't been able to sell their home, so they're renting the home out. And now you've got a tenant in there who's not paying. As we delay and stretch out our landlord-tenant files, not only are they not getting payments on these, but they've got tenants that are doing damages to those homes in the meantime, and sometimes running up astronomical costs that are magnified because we have to stretch out cases. Or a college student gets in a car accident. Fortunately, nobody's injured, but her car is totaled. So she brings a case in conciliation court. Now, one of the things that we're talking about having to do is put a suspension on her conciliation court cases. Now she's got no car. Now she's got no way to get back and forth. Ms. DeSalle talked about what happens when felony cases get stretched out for as long as a year. And many of those felony cases are drug cases, methamphetamine cases. Frankly, most of those cases ultimately resolve, but it's usually trial day before that happens. If it's a year, that's a year that that person is not in treatment. That's a year that that person is not getting help, at least that's ordered by the court. And that means they may very well be getting more and more hooked on the drug. They may be committing new offenses. We're then taking them into custody because they've committed new offenses, but we're not improving the rate of cure from the drug problems. Or think of the woman who she and her children are subjected to domestic abuse. And they, you know, at last, she kind of steals up her courage. She comes to the courthouse to apply for an order for protection and finds the window is closed. Does she have the strength to come back a second time? We don't know. And that's part of the thing that's scary, is that sometimes we don't realize some of the impacts that are happening. We know these are the kinds of things that could very well be happening, and if the budget situation gets tougher for the courts, that's going to magnify. You've heard about advancements that we've been doing in the courts. You've heard about technology and efficiencies, and we've done those things, and we're going to keep doing those things. But we're still first and foremost a people business. Most of what we've got depends upon the ability of our court people to interact with the public, to answer questions, to help the litigants, the jurors, the witnesses, the lawyers through that process. That gets to be magnified as well as we are seeing the number of people who come to court without a lawyer increase, and increase at great levels. If the cuts continue, the justice system will suffer in Minnesota. Now, I know the commitment that you have made over and over and over again to keep our courts strong. I've seen several consecutive budget cycles where the legislature has stood behind the courts, where the Senate has done that, the House has done that. And I know you've got tough times now. This is not an easy time to do that. But in the midst of that, I'm asking for and encouraging your ongoing support, the support that you've always shown, and the support that we continue to need as we try to continue to serve the public and provide the kind of justice system that Minnesotans need, that Minnesotans deserve, and that our form of government promises and guarantees to them. those are the things that we're looking for. So thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions that you would have.
Sarah Betzel.
Thank you. Judge Muzzle, we had the public defenders in the other day, and of course they try to talk about the system, you know, from their point of view, and you obviously see it from the bench as well. Can you also comment about how cuts to the public defender system affects how you're able to do your job as a judge?
Senator Betzel, Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, absolutely. I will tell you, it's true. What happens is that the public defenders that I see are extraordinarily qualified in the work that they do. The problem is that as their caseloads get big, they have a hard time adequately preparing for each of the cases that they have. I also find that they're in multiple courtrooms. And so it's virtually a daily occurrence when I'm in criminal court that I'll be waiting for a public defender to come in because she or he is handling cases in another courtroom as well. It becomes difficult for them to manage their cases, and frankly, there are a lot of their clients who then become dissatisfied with the representation and become distrustful of the whole system, because they're sitting around wondering why their lawyer is not there, and by the time the lawyer gets there, they're so irritated, they don't trust the work that's being done by them. We've got some highly qualified people, but as they're overloaded, that does become a choke point in the process, and that does affect the not only the quality of justice, but the sense of justice that I think is very important as people come into my courtroom. I work very hard on that.
Thank you.
I would only follow that by another suggestion that that's a Gideon violation, and really the people you're talking about are not getting what the Constitution says they should get.
Senator Foley, I think that that day could very well be at hand. I think we are at serious risk that that there could be a Gideon versus Wainwright challenge, and that could be a very genuine issue.
I take it because you're both there that we can go back and forth and get a
sure.
Judge Knudsen, tell us how you missed the good old Senate.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Knutson. I serve as a district court judge down in Dakota County in the 1st Judicial District, and it's a pleasure to be here and see each one of you, but not necessarily under these circumstances. And I think that leads to my answer to your question. I don't envy your jobs, and we've been saying that to the legislators we've been meeting with and explaining the plight of the courts. This is a very, very difficult time, but we're here to tell you that the judicial branch understands that. We've had the Tom-Toms come over and talk to the Judicial Council, Tom Gillespie to tell us about the demographics, and Tom Stinson to tell us about the economics, and Tom Hansen to tell us about cuts. And we've done that a couple times in the last year and a half or so that the judicial branch can have a clear understanding of where this economy is headed and where the state of Minnesota is going. And so we want to share and explain to you that we're a partner in trying to deliver the services without any increases. And we know how difficult this job is going to be. And so we've done a lot of the things that Sue DeSalle just went through with you, the Access and Service Delivery Committee, the studying of what we can do differently, how we can increase technology and all the rest of it. But the bottom line is that these reductions in revenues, the cuts that we're undertaking right now have serious consequences to the folks that are our constituents that appear in front of us every day. Now, let me just answer one of Senator Betzel's question that he asked Judge Meslow here about the impact of public defenders. And yesterday, I had a long calendar, and a woman showed up on bench warrants. She had five or six files and bench warrants on every single one of those files. She's got five kids. She lives in the northern part of Dakota County, and if you know where Hastings is, there's no public transportation out to Hastings. But she made it to court. Miracle of miracles. She showed up now. My question is, do I take her away, and there's no public defenders in my courtroom to handle her case? And my question is, will she show up another time? Or do I take her into custody, take her away from her five kids, get social services involved on that end, because I've got warrants out, and she hasn't shown up, and she's disobeying court orders? Or do I take a risk on her, and do I ask her to show up this morning at 9 a.m.? I look her in the eyes, and I say, you promised me you're going to show up tomorrow morning. So I ask her how she's going to get here, what ride, who she's going to call. So she explained to me how this was all going to go down, and so I trusted her. I wasn't going to take the mother away of five kids. But yet we've got all these files backed up, and we can't clear the files unless she shows up. We can't clear the files when she shows up unless she's got adequate representation. And so this morning we wanted to make sure that there was a calendar that with some public defenders on it, and there was. And as of 11:45 when I left the courthouse, she had not yet been seen or able to be her case handled yet. And there were questions on whether or not there was even a public defender ready, willing, or able to handle her case. And so the clerks were asking me, what do they do? You know, do we set this out another month and she doesn't show up? I mean, these are misdemeanors. These are driving after violations, no insurance violations, some of the things that we're trying to deal with the payable list. But anyway, Senator Betzel, that's an answer somewhat to your question. Real life happened to me yesterday and today about the shortage of the public defenders. We can't operate unless we're all adequately funded. It's hand and glove, and we all go together. It's the three-legged stool, whatever analogy you want to make. But the justice system is all intertwined.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Judge Knutson, at what point is the appropriate thing to do to dismiss all of those cases against her?
Well, right, and at that point, we would ask the prosecutor, can we take a look at dismissing some of these? And I did that yesterday. Can we take a look? Sure, but they weren't. We had to call them by phone because they weren't there on the day that she showed up yesterday. But I checked so that a lot of them had other court appearances at the courthouse this morning. So I can't unilaterally dismiss them, but the city attorneys, the prosecutors could, and they're really willing to work and figure out something. But still, she needs somebody independent of a prosecutor to guide her through and to have a public defender kind of sort it through for her. But those are the faces that appear in front of us, and we're at wit's end as to how and when can I get these people back on my calendar? We're talking months out. So you can't try the case today. Can you try it in 3 months or 2 months? I mean, that's how far out we are. But I want to share with you quickly and briefly some things that are happening around the state. I'll give you some of these other examples that are happening everywhere, but these are some from some specific counties. So in Aiken County, they had a woman that request a copy of her divorce decree. Well, it took a week to get the certified copy out in the mail, and apparently she was in need of some kind of medication and money and couldn't get any of those things because her ex-husband had passed away. She needed the divorce decree to continue her benefits. The county up there, the court staff wasn't aware of that till she called and she was crying, and they got the decree out within a day, but if they had adequate staff, it would have been... done in a day. So until you know those circumstances, these kinds of photocopies and processing mail and handling those kinds of things doesn't get done. That gets pushed down low on the priority list. And then also in Aiken County, they've got juvenile hearings from December where they have not yet entered the Minsis information. So you've gone a month and a half, almost 2 months, and that information isn't in the computer yet because the clerks don't have time to sit down and process that day's calendar. In Hennepin County, the criminal hearing office has had an increase of more than 22% in 1 year compared from 08 to 09. Hearing officer appointments are out 4 months. The wait to go see a hearing officer once you've got that appointment was about 30 minutes in 08. And now it's about 90 minutes for the when you walk in to see a hearing officer. Appearances on their payable pretrial calendars are more than 4 months out. In Olmsted County, misdemeanor trials are out 13 months. In Sibley County, a court-appointed attorney application was not reviewed in a timely manner in a termination case. So parental rights are being terminated, and the mom wanted to appeal the termination. Well, the application was piled on a desk, didn't get reviewed in a timely manner, and the litigant then was time-barred because the appeal time had run. But fortunately, they were able to work out. They drafted some stipulation, and we're going to try to allow her to continue the appeal. But we're talking about serious stuff here. Steele County divorces are bumped out because of speedy trial demands. They're getting set for September to get a divorce. Criminal trials in Steele County are out and being set in November. In Winona County, conciliation court was out about 6 to 12 weeks. They're now out about 16 weeks. Trials in Winona, 3 to 4 months. Previously, they're now out 9 months. Judgment enforcements, they were caught up. Now they're behind 2 to 3 months. So that's docketing judgments. So people finally get into court. They finally get their court order mailed out after months and weeks. And then to just get that judgment docketed so that they can go and collect on that judgment so they can keep jobs in the state of Minnesota, keep their business going. In Rice County, now everyone's going to get out their violins here now because we're talking about our former colleague, Senator Neville, Judge Neville. two of their three judges now are going to retire within 3 months of each other. One just retired.
So Tom's the only one left.
Tom is the only one left.
But he's a senior judge.
Yes. He gets a better parking space now. So obviously, you go from three to one. His workload's going to increase, and of course, the Judicial Council policy, we're trying to save any amount of money we can, so we're keeping those judgeships open 4+ months. And so some of the other third district judges are going to have to fill in Rice County, but then that leaves their counties short. And there's really no funds in the third district to pay for any retired or senior judges, so they're not able to fill in on that basis. So Judge Neville's going to have to delay many cases. And, you know, we can say, well, the judges can work harder. No question about that. We're all happy to do that. But we can't have night court. We can't have weekend court because our staff isn't going to be there. We can't afford to pay the staff. We can't afford to pay the staff and keep the staff that we've got now just working 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. We've looked at these issues every which way in this access and service delivery on trying to solve some of these problems. So he's going to be in a world of hurt, and I've offered to send him letters of consolation, but I don't know if that's going to make much difference. Well, that's just some snippets of court, from the court, but you know where you really find out how we're doing and how it's impacting clients and our constituents is from our users and from our clients. And the Minnesota State Bar Association surveyed its members, and here's just a sample of some of the responses. The reduction in court services for the Hennepin County Conciliation Court has been very noticeable. I'm an attorney for the city of Bloomington and work on our DWI forfeiture cases. I'm seeing wait times to get into court as long as 8 months in some cases. And these cost the city storage fees, but mainly it denies some people the right to expedient court hearing on the forfeiture, and they're left without a car for months at a time. In Ramsey County Family Court, they've had to cut back resources and staff to the bare bones. This means that they will only do 12 custody and parenting evaluations per month. And as a judge, these people come before us and they try to tell us their stories, but we're really relying on some independent neutrals to come into court and tell us what the situation really is like for these parents and these kids and who would be the best parent to have legal and physical custody and what kind of parenting time should be recommended. Boy, when we don't have that, we're flying blind. And they've reduced their evaluations to only 12 per month. And There's six referees, three judges hearing family court cases. That means that numerous requests are being set out for over 6 months before they can get evaluations done in Ramsey County. And of course, it especially impacts those without any kind of resources, the poor, and because they don't have attorneys to represent themselves, they don't have the money to hire private guardians ad litem to look at these custody evaluations. Another respondent said, "I'm a criminal defense attorney. My client was charged with fifth-degree assault. It was a misdemeanor in July of 2008. The first trial setting was May of 2009." And then it was continued from May to September, and then from September to December, and now it's set for March of 2010, the trial on this. So each time it was continued, he says, due to judge unavailability. And by the time they finally go to trial, then my client is living with these criminal charges hanging over their head for all of that time. Another attorney writes and says a moderate income client runs a yard work snow plowing business. He's done this for more than 20 years at the same location. City now says he's violating zoning regulations for the same 20 plus years. He's also served as a volunteer firefighter. City's threatened to fire him if he does not shut down his business. They were scheduled to go to trial in July. I mean, these are your lifeblood, your career, your business, your source of income. They're hanging over your head, and you can't get into court and resolve them. And these are the cases, these civil types of cases particularly, are ones that we just, they're the only ones that constitutionally we can push back and slow down as much as possible. So they were scheduled for October. They got bumped in October to scheduled to February. So the cost of preparing the trial over and over again has far exceeded the client's ability to pay. And the stress and delays has resulted in at least one hospitalization of the client because of a possible heart attack. Then in Olmsted County, it can take 3 to 4 months to obtain a temporary hearing on dissolution matters. In Winona County, it's about 6 to 10 weeks to get a motion for temporary relief. And, you know, this is when the stress, the emotion, the strife is at its greatest when one has decided to file for divorce. And one of the first things often they do is try to get a temporary order to provide some clarity and some order to these parties' relationship. And when you can't get into court and you leave this thing simmering for so long, the emotional stress and then oftentimes the sometimes violence that occurs, we can't afford that.
You know, what's interesting, Judge Knudsen, is the fact that a few years back I was a captain of the state patrol and commanded the Golden Valley, Minneapolis area, and at that time, there was a 48-month delay in the DUI cases, so that they naturally plead not guilty, stretch it out for 4 years, and then have to dismiss it because the party moved away or witnesses moved away and so forth. That sounds like some of that's still coming back. The other part of that, of course, is that how many of those people that are incarcerated stay there because they're charged but they haven't been convicted.
Right. And by the time, Mr. Chairman, by the time I finally get around, we're able to have a calendar where the public defender is there, we're set on for an omnibus hearing, or we're set on for trial, we're ready to, the defendant's ready to plead guilty, you know, oftentimes it's like, well, what more can I do? They've already spent all this time in jail. They've sometimes up to a year. So we just say, okay, thanks, goodbye, we'll see you. Because we put them on probation, but to punish them more is they've been punished usually longer because of the delays than if they would have just if we would have been able to resolve it right away, and that's a shame. That's a real shame. But last spring, the Court of Appeals reversed two cases involving felony convictions for failure to meet the speedy trial demand. So the justice system is stretched to a breaking point, and I don't need to tell you folks, and we the entire branch appreciates the support of this committee and the efforts that you've made to to reduce the cuts to our branch. We know you're our supporters, but we really are asking the legislature to prioritize. We know how difficult this session's going to be. But if you take a look at what you really need to do and the core function of our government to provide justice to the citizens of the state, we know that you'll treat us fairly. So we're going to have to prioritize, and with all the in spite of all the changes, the efficiencies, the use of technology, and everything else, we're still going to have difficulty meeting the time demands that we've set for ourselves. And this is very difficult because we take a lot of pride in the justice system that's been established and the ability that this system has proved to serve the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And to suffer through this is not easy, and to watch some of these people in front of us every single day is difficult. So
I want to thank you, Judge Knutson. The many months or years that you and I worked together, and we managed to resolve some of the problems that existed then. Unfortunately, we're in a situation now where we've gone backward, and I don't see where we can continue to go in this direction. And I certainly would assure you that I'm doing my part in order to help the judicial branch, and I would only hope that you would discuss the matter with the governor and see if you can get a little more support from him. Senator Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge Knutson and Judge Meslow, I don't know if there's anything internally within court proceedings that can be done to, you know, maybe have a few savings. And I'll give you an example. I think in some courts, judges are placed on various calendars, you know, and you can have a case that will go through the system, and by the time it gets to trial, perhaps you've had various pretrial motions, whatever it is, and maybe four or five different judges have touched the file by the time it gets, you know, to the date of trial. That's the case in some counties, not others, whereas sometimes they just block it out, saying, okay, here's your cases, these are yours, however you want to handle them, go ahead and do it. You have specialty courts in the larger counties. Obviously, in Rice County, Judge Neville's going to handle everything, but when you have larger counties, districts, you might be able to put one judge on a specialty court, like, say, family law, and say, you're going to have to do this for a year or two. Now, I think there's some efficiencies. I think there's some efficiencies in saying if one judge is handling a certain kind of area cases, they might be able to get down to a system, being able to, you know, handle, work out, you know, figure out which really needs the attention, which doesn't. Do you see any efficiencies in any of that, or are there ways that the courts can handle things that might work to your advantage?
Sure. And I'll just give you an example of what one thing that we're doing in our district. We call them cringe groups. And it was case processing information work groups. And so how is it that we're processing our cases? We're trying to do anything and everything and analyze this, our systems, backwards and forwards to try to wring more efficiencies out of it. And so, you know, you could... I think what you're talking about is part of it's in my district in Dakota County. We don't have a blocked family court at this time, although a lot of people do ask that their cases be blocked, and then judges, if they pick up the file and it's particularly a contentious file, the judges will block oftentimes the case to themselves. And it's a good thing and a bad thing. And we've asked the bar in our area, how would you like the courts to handle this? And they're saying, look, the way you handle it, we try to move judges to the calendars. So if we've got a lot of cases set on for omnibus hearings, or we've got a particularly heavy trial calendar this month, we're going to move judges to handle all of that and take them off and not set other kinds of calendars. And so we want to say, you're going to get in as soon as we can possibly get you in, rather than what some of the counties do as well. You're scheduled for trial these 2 weeks, but I've got 20 or 30 cases set on for myself these 2 weeks, and then you're going to have to come back in some of the with like some of these examples that I gave you. You're going to have to come back next time my trial rotation comes around in 3 months. And if you don't get heard then, you'll have to come back 3 months after that. And so what we've been saying in the judicial branch is we don't have any room anymore for idiosyncrasies of individual judges or past practices from the 1940s or the 1950s. And so we're looking at that every day. What's the best way to handle this? Not only most efficiently for the system, but also for the litigants and the parties, so that they're not preparing time and time again and not having a judge available or not having a jury panel available to try their case. So believe me, we're taking a good look at what is the best way to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and good luck, members of the committee. And,
Mr. Chair, before they leave, Sarah Knudsen and I came in together in 1992. There were 16 of us. And now with Senator Dill and Senator Murphy announcing the retirements, it was down to basically Senator Anderson and me. That's
two
it.
Two left. Our champions.
Well, whatever.
Did you do that thing where there was a bottle of wine for the last one who finished?
I think Senator Anderson is going to have to finish it off.
So what you're saying is we're almost there. Almost
there. Yeah, right. We'll fight over it.
In order to get moving again, I
line for the last one standing.
Want to bring forth Gary Hurd. Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Chairman Foley, senators, committee staff, thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today to discuss the impact of likely supplemental budget reductions on Minnesota's civil legal services. My name is Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for SMRLS, Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. And joining me today to help address any questions you may have is Kathy Hockadahl. She's the Deputy Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. Together, our programs serve 53 of Minnesota's 87 counties and over 70% of the state's poverty population. We are here today representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition and to speak to the impact of the civil legal services component of the Supreme Court budget. By way of overview, my presentation will cover three topics. First, I will provide a general description of Minnesota's legal services. Second, I'll try to give you a sense of the impact the state's investment in civil legal services is having in our communities, in the lives of lower-income Minnesotans, and to support the integrity of the state's justice system. And finally, I'll try to provide some context to support the committee's efforts to develop a supplemental budget recommendation. Minnesota Legal Services Coalition is a statewide resource. It's comprised of seven regional legal assistance agencies that are members of the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition. We deliver services in every county in the state, and then there are an additional approximately two dozen community and specialty practice programs that are also funded by the state appropriation. Together, these regional and local legal services providers share the mission of assuring access to open, affordable, and understandable services for all Minnesotans, regardless of income. They provide direct legal assistance to Minnesota families, handling approximately 52,900 cases in 2008, and they reach nearly 70,000 Minnesotans through legal education and preventive law services. The services delivered through Minnesota's civil legal services have a real impact in improving the lives of Minnesota residents. They help people solve problems that result in real changes, reducing family domestic violence, keeping kids in school, securing housing, assuring access to health care, helping families achieve economic self-reliance, and assuring that our most vulnerable are protected and are treated fairly. While many Minnesotans benefit from the assistance offered by legal services providers, the need remains great. Based upon the last census, it is estimated that 1.2 million Minnesotans qualify for services, and that approximately two-thirds of the need for assistance goes unmet. In other words, for each person who receives service, two are turned away. And at a time of severe economic challenges and chronic budget pressures, it becomes even more difficult to close the gap in need. In the past year, Minnesota's legal services programs experienced a 40% increase in requests for services. The simple fact is that our services are counter-cyclical. The need for civil legal services increases during times of economic downturns. And many of those new people coming through our doors seeking help to cope with the recession's impact are people who did not expect to ever need or even qualify for help from a legal aid agency. As was observed by Brown County District Court Judge John Rodenberg, needs rise in five areas during economic downturns: evictions, foreclosures, domestic violence, credit problems, and crime. When you look at this list, four of those five are among civil legal services priority service areas. Civil legal services helps families facing job loss, personal finance and credit crises, loss of housing or mortgage foreclosure, need for emergency assistance, or the threat of domestic violence. In fact, at Smurls, we saw our foreclosure cases double from the first half to the second half of 2008. In short, in addition to being an essential part of Minnesota's system providing access to justice, civil legal services also needs to be considered to be part of the state's overall strategy for helping Minnesotans achieve economic recovery. Civil legal services also have an important impact on public safety. One of the largest parts of our service is in family law, including addressing the impact of domestic and sexual violence. In fact, a recent study showed that the one factor that could be correlated with reductions in the rates and the resulting harm of domestic violence in a community was the availability of legal aid services. As an added point, you should know that legal aid played an important role in helping to develop a bench guide that is now being used in courtrooms throughout the state to help judges assess the lethality in domestic violence cases. Legal aid services also have an impact on public safety by reducing school failure and truancies by helping families stabilize their housing. Success in school has been shown to have a significant impact on the community and public safety by reducing long-term risk for criminal behavior. In addition to promoting economic security and public safety, civil legal services plays a role in lowering the cost of government in Minnesota. When legal aid helps a family resolve a housing issue, which we did in over 2,650 cases during the past year, we also help reduce the need for $4 million in tax-supported shelters. By resolving child support cases, we bring down the annual need for public assistance by approximately $4 million. Each year, we help people obtain Social Security disability benefits, amounting to about $5 million every year, so that the cumulative impact of that on both income and savings to the state in health programs has a cumulative effect of approximately $275 million over 10 years. Civil legal services along with the courts and public defenders, are an essential element of Minnesota's justice system and a core government service. As observed by Chief Justice Magnuson, in tough economic times, we need to pay attention to the basics. And in our state, in our society, one of the basics is an adequately funded justice system, a system that includes civil legal services, not only to assure access to justice for all, but also to make Minnesota's justice system more efficient. Civil legal services is, in some respects, an efficiency program within the justice system. Legal aid reduces the number of cases with unrepresented parties appearing in court, a valuable time saver in the courtroom. We also relieve burdens on the courts by keeping over 3,000 cases annually from finding their way to the courtroom. We do that by advising people that their case is not going to be successful in court. Our ability to work with clients to find alternatives to resolving civil legal disputes reduces court costs by approximately $5 million annually. If civil legal services were not already a part of Minnesota's justice system, the courts would have to create it in order to maintain the current efficiencies. He's still here.
He's got hair, though.
It was an earlier picture.
Obviously.
Because we've had to deal with inadequate funding for a very long time, operating economically and efficiently is a way of doing business in legal aid. Evaluating and improving our systems for delivering services, as observed by District Court Judge David Knudsen, is an ongoing, integrated part of how we do our work. We have seen over a 10% reduction in service capacity through the past several years. At Smurls, we have lost 15% of our attorney staff in the past 2 years. MMLA closed their office in Cambridge and laid off staff. There have been similar impacts throughout the civil legal services system. We have reallocated resources to limit the focus of our work to crisis needs. We have integrated technology improvements to ease access to services and improve efficiency of internal systems. We have found ways to keep costs low by collaborating on training for our staff and other professionals who help us meet our clients' needs. And perhaps most importantly, we have benefited from the high-quality, high-value services provided by a motivated workforce and committed volunteers. This is a workforce that delivers results even though their salaries are the lowest in the court system. As a conclusion of my presentation, I want to share with you some perspective on what's been happening with state funding for civil legal services, a sense of what the supplemental budget proposal that has been offered by the administration means for the availability of civil legal services to your constituents, and information that we hope will be useful in the committee's supplemental budget proposal. As you can see, state funding for civil legal services has been on the decline. Last year, when adopting the budget for the 2010-11 biennium, civil legal services experienced an 8.3% reduction in funding because of the one-time money from the previous session. This is disproportionately greater than the 0.83% reduction experienced in other parts of the justice system. The impact was an elimination of services for approximately 3,000 Minnesota families. By way of further comparison, not only has the reduction in state funding for civil legal services been greater than those experienced by the justice system as a whole, but the cuts have moved civil legal services budget to a level below 2006, the only part of the justice system to dip back to such funding levels. The supplemental budget proposal presented by the governor continues this trend of disproportionate cuts in state funding for civil legal services. While essentially all other parts of the justice system are recommended to receive 3% cuts, civil legal services has been singled out for a 6% reduction. The impact of a reduction at this level would reduce legal services staff by nearly a dozen people and reduce our ability to serve an additional 2,100 families. This is on top of the cut in capacity to serve over 3,000 families is already part of the budget for this biennium. In closing, I'd like to acknowledge the history of bipartisan support within the legislature, both for the justice system and the role civil legal services plays in defining the overall integrity of that system. Justice is not a partisan issue. I also want to acknowledge the leadership of Chief Justice Eric Magnuson and our partners in the Coalition to Preserve Minnesota's Justice System, the Minnesota Supreme Court, the public defenders, prosecutors, the Minnesota State Bar Association, and others who share our commitment to having a justice system that is viable and protects access to justice for all of our state citizens. A sense of confidence in the courts is essential to maintain the fabric of ordered liberty for a free people, and three things could destroy that confidence and do incalculable damage to society. That people come to believe that inefficiency and delay will drain even a just judgment of its value. That people who have long been exploited in the smaller transactions of daily life come to believe that courts cannot vindicate their legal rights from fraud and overreaching. That people come to believe the law, in the larger sense, cannot fulfill its primary function to protect them and their families in their homes, at their work, and on the public streets. That's a quote from Chief Justice Warren Burger from 1970. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you, and we'd certainly entertain any questions.
Questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, just as an aside, you just flashed on some of the directors. I was on the board of directors of Judicare of Anoka County in the early 80s, and that program was in absolute turmoil. And I was part of the group that hired Floyd Panuski, and he's 30 years later, he's still there. So I think we figured out how to get that program straight. So, there.
Is there any further questions, comments? Did you wish to speak to the committee?
No, I just wanted to make myself available for questions.
Thank you. We do have the Bar Association representation. Did you want to speak on behalf of the Bar?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leo Brisbois. I'm the current president of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and I hadn't expected to comment, but other than to say that we have worked closely with the coalition members of which you've just heard, and as a profession, we recognize that we're all into this together. Our clients cannot have their cases heard but for an adequately funded court system that is efficient and affordable. And towards that end, as a profession, last session, we worked closely with members of this committee, members of Representative Paymire's committee in the House, to try and identify those areas where we could enhance revenues through fees without jeopardizing the affordability and access of members of our clients to the courts. I think we've gone down that road and we've exhausted that opportunity. The other area where the bar has stepped in to help is during the interim and attorney license fee increases to help close the public defender's gap. We've also kind of gone down and exhausted that road. The clients cannot continue to absorb those increases to close these gaps and so that the courts are accessible. Last week, there was an article in Minnesota Lawyer, and it may be in your materials. I don't know if it is or not. But the increase in fees has resulted in the unintended consequences of increased petitions for informa pauperis. So we're at that tipping point where additional fee increases really are a zero-sum gain because people cannot afford to pay them, the clients and the people who use the system. I know it's not a positive thing, but the profession has tried in those areas to come as far forward as we can to help you do what you need to do. In the areas of civil legal service, the members of the bar and the profession have as a aspirational goal the performance of pro bono services. Minnesota leads the nation in the number of hours, one of the states that lead the nation in the number of hours that are delivered to that. The state bar's pro bono report for 2009 will be coming out this spring. That'll show those numbers. So the profession is trying to do what it can to help in this process, because again, as I said, unless the courts are adequately funded and functioning, the clients can't access them to resolve their redress. Moreover, the courts are the crucible in which everything else we do in the state gets resolved. There's a lot of talk right now about jobs being job one. But if the disputes, business disputes, contract disputes cannot be timely and adequately resolved in the courts, business slows down. Business slows down, jobs lost. So it's a much bigger than just the question of how many staff, how many cases per month. You know, this is an issue that affects the entirety of what we do in Minnesota in all areas. And because the courts affect everything that everybody does in this state in one way or another, either directly or indirectly. And that's why the Bar Association's been trying to be as much of an active part of the coalition as possible. As I said, I probably talked more than anybody expected and more than I expected, but I do want it on behalf of the 17,000 members of the Bar Association, thank the members of this committee, members of the Senate, members of the House, for the hard work that you did last year and the work that you're going to be doing this year as well. On behalf of all our clients and all Minnesotans, thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Apparently not. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll give the wisdom of my position here that I want to let you know that next Tuesday I intend for our division debate and bring out the supplemental language and the spreadsheet recommended by the full finance. I intend to make that spreadsheet publicly available on Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. and we'll have a copy in your offices before that time. We set aside time at the beginning of the meeting for anyone who wants to give brief testimony on behalf of the proposed Senate cuts. And if there's no other business, meeting adjourned.
Okay. Thank you.
See you all. How are you doing?
Good.